Senate Judiciary Budget Division Committee come to order today. It is Tuesday, February 26th. And as you can see, I've got a sore throat. But let us start with the judicial branch in whatever order that you want.
Chairman Foley and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Shorba. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. I'm joined today by Judge Ed Lynch, who's the Assistant Chief Judge of the First Judicial District and also the chair of our Legislative Advisory Work Group. I want to begin by thanking you for allowing us to come before you to discuss our supplemental budget request. Before I present our supplemental request, I think it would be helpful just to provide you with a brief overview of our current biennial budget situation. Last year, the judicial branch requested $66.3 million in new funding for the current biennium. The court's final appropriation was $46.7 million. The blue sheet in your packet will provide in detail a comparison of the branch request and the appropriation. Although grateful for the amount of new funding we got from the legislature for this biennium, the inability to sufficiently fund the court's compensation request, coupled with the manner in which we received some of the funding with rider language, really reduced the flexibility for us to meet our branch-wide personnel needs. As you will see from the sheet, we got a little less than $12.9 million than what we asked for in our personnel needs. Unlike other parts of state government, the courts do not have large programs that can be cut back in tough times. Approximately 85% of our budget go to judges and court personnel who are involved in the adjudication process across the state. Last year, we requested $38.9 million for judge and staff compensation. We based that request on a fairly conservative estimate of a 2.5% cost of living adjustment plus steps and insurance. As you saw from the budget overview sheet in your packets, the branch received $12.9 million less than we requested for compensation, based on a formula used to provide 3% for all compensation increases, COLA, insurance, pension adjustments, et cetera. After the close of the session and following the pattern of union negotiations by the larger executive branch agencies, judicial branch COLAs were set at 3.25%, plus costs of steps and insurance. This lack of sufficient funding and a greater than anticipated COLA increase created a large hole in our personnel budget and has required the branch to take some significant measures to stay within a balanced budget. At this time, I think it's important to point out and discuss some of those measures that we've already taken, and so I'll turn it over to Judge Ed Lynch, who can talk a little bit about the cost-cutting measures that we've already implemented.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Lynch. I'm a judge in the 1st District, and I'm chambered in Dakota County. When it became apparent that the judicial branch would be unable to fund our current compensation obligations, the Judicial Council instructed the district administrators and the state court administrator's office to identify and implement some aggressive cost-saving measures. These measures are on the slide, and I'll just briefly review them with you. Administrators have determined that 178 positions, roughly 6% of our statewide staff, will need to be held open or abolished in order to save enough funds to meet our current compensation obligation. In those districts that cannot accomplish these savings through attrition, layoffs will be necessary. Some of the districts have offered voluntary early separation programs to their employees. At this time, it is anticipated that 42 employees will take advantage of this offer. Employees throughout the state are being asked to take unpaid days off. As part of your packet, we have included a newspaper article from the 3rd Judicial District where employees, wanting to be part of the solution, have agreed to take time off without pay to save positions. In Rochester alone, enough time has been volunteered to save the equivalent of one position. Courthouses in at least 3 districts, the 3rd, the 4th, and the 10th, will be closing public counters at least one afternoon a week to enable staff to catch up on data entry and other tasks that cannot be done because of the positions that are left open or abolished. All levels of court are scrutinizing operational budgets to identify cost containment measures. But as you know, since our budget is almost all personnel, Any savings that can be realized by purchasing cheaper printer paper is not going to make much of an impact on the problem and will not lessen significantly the need to cut staff. Fewer conciliation court calendars are being scheduled in some counties, and other service cutbacks are also being discussed. The 3rd and the 10th districts have submitted letters to the chair that are part of the packet of materials that we have provided you, and I just want to highlight some of the initiatives that they're taking. The 10th district will hold open 17 and a half positions and expects to lay off an additional 10 employees. They plan to close a court facility in Cottage Grove, reduce collection efforts, and discontinue accepting credit card payments because of the fee charged by the credit card companies that's against our court budget. The 3rd district must reduce staffing level by approximately 15% and expects to abolish 6.5 positions, consolidate court administrator positions, and extend jury terms. I know that you understand that cost-cutting measures do not affect the overall judicial branch workload. Cases will continue to be filed at the rate of over $2 million each year, and so the remaining staff will be asked to do more with less. We can't close the courts one day each week and reduce our workload by 400,000 cases. The work does not go away, it merely piles up. I don't consider myself an alarmist. I'm not here to say that the judicial branch sky is falling, but I am afraid that the strain caused by the budget problems is beginning to crack the foundation. I've never seen before, and I've been a judge for almost 19 years, I've never seen before the level of concern, stress, frustration, and just plain exhaustion that's pervasive in most of the court facilities in our state. It's not a question anymore of whether we can improve the quality of service we provide. It is a question of whether we can meet our constitutional duty to provide meaningful access to justice and whether we can ask our already overwhelmed court employees to adjust to an even faster speed on the justice system assembly line. In the past, in order to respond to increased work and limited resources, the courts have relied on improved technology, better management, and implementing better and best practices, and also have asked judges and staff to take on more and more responsibility. These options have been spent. I'm afraid that there are no rabbits left in the hat to take out to absorb additional costs or cuts. We need your continued support to ensure that justice is not a victim of chronic underfunding or the increase in demands for mandated services that are beyond our control. And I think Judge Whelan now has some comments from the 4th District.
Members have any questions for Judge Whelan?
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, there's a related question. It's not on specifically what you talked about, but there are a couple bills right now advocating that the mandatory retirement age of judges be extended to age 75. Do you have an opinion on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I don't intend to work till 75, and that's probably my only opinion. There is a high degree, I think, of burnout, and God love those who are willing and able to continue on, but I think that from my personal perspective, that's not a bill that I'd be pushing.
And Mr. Chair, there are times when judges after retirement, they're called back into service on temporary action. And does that extend past that age of 70 when that occurs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it's my understanding that what we call now senior judges are able to work as long as they seem to have the capability and capacity to do a good job. So there isn't the age restriction on those who serve as senior judges.
And, Mr. Chair, who would make that judgment of whether or not they're capable of handling that responsibility? Do they go through some type of review if they're anticipating wanting to be pressed into temporary service?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, it's my understanding that each senior judge has to be approved for work every year by the Chief Justice.
And even the temporary?
Yes, and, right. And even that when they're working as retired judges or senior judges. And during that determination, I think that there's a solicitation of those areas where the judge has worked in the past year to determine whether there's any concerns about the ability of the judge to continue on.
Right. Mr. Chair, do you think we should maybe entertain something that, like a 70 or 75-year-old age for mandatory retirement of legislators?
Thanks a lot.
Nasty.
I'll withdraw the question.
Did you want to add anything, Sherman?
No, Judge Lynch is correct. That's the process that we use for senior judges.
And tell me how many senior judges have you got at any one time?
Well, we, Mr. Chair, we have a roster of senior judges who have gone through the process to be approved by the Chief Justice, and then they can be used in various districts across the state. So every year we put together that roster. I'm not exactly sure the total number that are on it right now, but I can let you know if you need to know that.
Mr. Chair, could you just tell me how those senior judges that are pulled in from early retirement, we'll call it, how are they paid? Is there a rate or something? I mean, how do you determine that? Just for a point of interest.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, they're paid on a daily rate. It's around $325, something like that, dollars per day.
Just one more question, if I could. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understand this right, then last year when we appropriated the money that we did, we came up short because contracts now have come. The contracts were actually settled after we got done appropriating. Is that fair?
That is correct.
So we're kind of with a shortfall.
Well, there's two shortages. One is that the amount that we requested, we didn't get full funding of the amount we requested. And then the second contributing factor was that the contracts came in higher than even the estimates that we had at the beginning of the legislative session.
Chair, we should clarify that wasn't unique to the judicial branch. We had an across-the-board appropriation for all agencies, including the judicial branch, for everybody. We appropriated the money for 3%. But then in the collective bargaining process, the contracts were being settled, mainly in the executive branch, at 3.25%. In the judicial, once the trend was set, that's what everybody settled
sure.
for.
So, that, yeah.
So, you know, and obviously the judicial branch would have had a problem if they would have said, well, I see what everybody else is doing, but we're going to hold the line at 3%. They would have had a problem in their own bargaining process. So, that issue is going to be coming before the Finance Committee and before the legislature as we have those contract ratifications for the ones we have. We obviously don't, the legislature doesn't ratify a contract for the judicial branch, but we will have those other collective bargaining ones that we will see.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. That's a 2-year contract they deal with, or is it yearly? I guess I don't even know that.
2 years.
2 years. Is it term? Okay. All right. Thanks.
Welcome. Would you please state your name for the record?
My name is Lucy Whelan. Chairman Foley and members of the Judiciary Budget Division, I'm the Chief Judge in the 4th Judicial District, which is Hennepin County. I was asked to come and share with you the cost-cutting measures that we have had to implement in our county to meet our budget pressures. And I would say that in FY08, our district faced a budget deficit of $1.4 million, and that was due primarily to the unfunded increases in our employee costs, as well as some unanticipated costs in the implementation of the Mensis in our the case information system in our criminal division. Let me begin by saying that Hennepin County, the district court, has been a leader both in Minnesota and nationally in terms of the focus we place on access and public service. And just a few of the innovations we've launched over the years are a nationally recognized self-help center, a hearing office that offers evening appointments for individuals with minor traffic tickets, and a domestic violence service center. But most of our court's budget is in personnel, and as we faced a $1.4 million deficit, we had to address that by a hiring freeze. And we actually put that hiring freeze in place in November. With the kind of significant employee vacancies that generated, we've had to curtail services. And just to give you some sense of the scope of this, we are now holding open over 40 positions in our court. And this is 10% of our operational staff. So we have seen some significant changes in our daily operations.
Can you tell me what those people are, the courts are, if you know
primarily court clerks. A few of these changes are walk-in counter and telephone services are closed after 1:30 every Wednesday. What that means is that people can't come in person to pay tickets, request court files, or get updates. This time that we've set aside for our staff allows them to do the computer updating that they're not able to do given, you know, during the regular day because of the staff vacancies. We've reduced our conciliation court calendars by a third, and this has resulted in delays in scheduling hearings. We eliminated our supervised visitation services to non-custodial parents and their children in family court. We eliminated our civil arbitration program and will no longer provide arbitrators for alternative dispute resolution in civil court. We stopped conducting criminal record checks for the public, and instead we refer them to the BCA Public Access website. We still have a reduced number of district court staff available on Wednesday afternoons for the walk-in customers needing orders for protection, but we don't give appointments any longer. And as we look at next year, where we also see additional deficits, in addition to continuing what we've already done, we are looking at closing our Ridgedale Courthouse, reducing staff in the Self-Help Center and in the Domestic Abuse Service Center. And you know, I think what I want to point out here is that all of this is happening at a time when our work is increasing. And I think in your packet, there's a green sheet you got, which is an article about the increasing number of loan default cases being filed. We actually didn't orchestrate this, believe it or not. It just coincidentally happened. What the article points out is the increase in the number of loan default cases. The number statewide has grown 67% from 2006 to 2007. In Hennepin County alone, the number of default judgments grew 71% from 2006 to 2007. So we just don't have the staff to process this increased paperwork, given the vacancies I just talked about. And so it now takes as long as 6 weeks to process these cases instead of what used to be 2 weeks in the past. I also wanted to just talk about our housing court for a minute. We have had record numbers of filings in our housing court, huge increases there, and again, that's due primarily to mortgage foreclosures and the fact that many of these, if not most of these mortgage foreclosures, end up in the housing court cases. Another point I wanted to raise was just our homicide first-degree crim sex cases. These were up over 27% in 2007 over 2006. Again, this is the kind of case that has tremendous impact on our jury budget, because these are the kind of cases where the standards call for 50 jurors to be brought in on those kinds of cases because so many jurors recuse themselves. And so our jury budget costs go up, and that is in part, those are the kind of costs we really can't control. These are just the costs, but the costs that we have to bear. You know, so in summation, I just want to echo what Judge Lynch said, which is this is a really very stressful time for the courts. I came here from an employee recognition event, and, you know, we had over 90 employees being recognized for over 5 years of service to the court. Some one employee, 40 years they've worked for Hennepin County District Court. And it's a wonderful event, but, you know, there is tremendous strain in our court right now. I really feel concerned about our ability to keep our heads above water if we have to continue this for too much longer. Anybody have any questions?
I understand. We went through that last year, and we knew at that point that we didn't have the money for all of the things that we were requesting. I quite knew that. Unfortunately, we weren't able to do much then. We're really I guess we're interested in some additional funds to help not only you but others. And mm-hmm. The alternative, of course, is related to the things you've cited, and probably a lot worse than where we are. The thing is, unlike now, Senator Ingberg's would want to kind of get a feel for what items are you looking at that are new and weren't part of the application?
Senator Foley, and are you talking about new things that we've instituted, or?
Well, not so much instituted, but you would like to and if what I'm interested in more than anything else is that the amount of what you might have done might have been changed, and you might have a priority on some items that weren't in the forefront the last time.
I can talk about two things in particular, Senator Foley, and members of the committee. One of these is in the whole self-help center area. On the one hand, Hennepin County has been lucky because we've had a self-help center, and that is not a service that's generally available around the rest of the state. And one of the things that we have had in our strategic plan for the court is expanding this service, and it's actually a really innovative idea because it's almost a virtual self-help center where through computer access and phone access and other courthouses and all the courthouses around the state, they would have access to self-help services, some from our center, and then some through the state court website, which there's been a lot of work done on to have the forms and the kind of information available that people need. You know, that whole initiative really is in jeopardy right now, in part because one of the things we're looking at cutting is our own self-help center, which is really the basis for the statewide effort. So that's an example. I mean, it's something we so much do not want to do. You know, I think that this division is familiar with the demographics of our court users, and they need that. I mean, many of them can't afford attorneys. They don't speak English. It is a very, very important service that center provides. But at the end of the day, this is how we look at this. We say we have a core business, you know, which is conducting hearings, updating our information system, doing our filings, and that has to come first. And so those are really, really tough choices. But the self-help center is one of them. The second one really are some of the technology initiatives we've looked at, and I'll give you a good example. One of the ones it has to do with electronic charging. This is something that I think has tremendous potential for law enforcement and prosecutors in particular, because if we can move into an electronic charging area in the criminal area, you do away with the need for the police officers to travel downtown. You can do all of this electronically, and it saves on data entry for a lot of people. It's just a far more efficient way for not just the court, but for all of our partner agencies. And again, that's something that, you know, that requires you know, a significant amount of time and money to accomplish. So those are just two of the things I think.
Did you institute that at some point
Well, we have our new information system, which is MNSIS, which is capable of that kind of integration. But there is still additional work that has to be done for that to become a reality.
And Mr. Chair? Judge Wieland, would you tell us a little how MNSIS is doing these days? I know that you've got some struggles on simple things like court calendars.
We do have some struggles. And, you know, let me say, first of all, that you know, I'm the biggest fan of the statewide information system. And the reason I say that is because for the first time, and I just did felony arraignments last week, so I had a firsthand view of it. For the first time, we have statewide criminal history data. And so our corrections department, when they're preparing a bail evaluation for me, I mean, I'm getting everything, all criminal history statewide from misdemeanor to felony. We know warrants from other parts of the state. We know all of this. So when I talk about the problems, I'm not saying it that, you know, from the standpoint of thinking this was a bad idea. Oh, it's a great idea. But we're having very significant problems with it, and it's particularly true in our court because we are an integrated criminal justice system. Our sheriff, our county attorney, our city attorney, our public defender, we are all on, we're historically on the same system. We were not on the TSIS system like the rest of the state. We were on something called SIP, Subject and Process. And corrections is on that. So we have had to, Hennepin County actually built a new system, a broker system, to allow all of these partners to essentially communicate electronically. And that, combined with the stresses we placed, we meaning Hennepin, placed on the MNSA system because of our volume, you know, it's made for some serious challenges.
Oh, I don't feel neglected. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. In form of pompous cause, I talked to my two judges this weekend when I was home. They were saying that was getting to be a large increase to deal with that and many other things. In fact, they made me very well aware that you were coming today. You see a reason why that's going up? Is it going up drastically for you or not?
Well, I think, Senator Ingebrigtsen, in these hard economic times, we have more people who are coming in who cannot afford to pay some of these filing fee costs and other costs, and so we're finding more and more people coming to court for some of the things that Judge Whelan was pointing out who have very few finances, and so those costs are going up. We're hoping to try to deal with the increase this biennium, and we haven't put that in our supplemental request, but we are seeing it increase.
Yeah.
I know it's been an issue.
Well, we can't, you know, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we just had this discussion yesterday because tightening up on the IFPs has been one of the things that's sort of been brought forward as a way to cut some of our mandated service costs. The problem is, as was pointed out by the presiding judge in our family court, it costs $350 to file for divorce. And a lot of people, I mean, the filing fees are such that more and more people are struggling with that. So we're getting big increase in these IFP filing or petitions in some of our courts, our divisions.
What's IFP?
In form of pocket.
Oh, the do-it-yourself divorce?
Yeah. Services, for sure.
Instead of waiving the fees.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay. I used to know a song named the do-it-yourself divorce. The next line is, you have to be married, of course.
What have we done with the administrative law judges? It seems to me that, that we've added a number of those folks, and I'm not sure how your role fits into that. But, tell me what's going on in that.
Mr. Chair, the administrative law judges are part of the executive branch, and so are not part of the court budget or the judicial branch operations at all. We do have hearing officers and referees, and I'm sure Judge Whelan can talk a little bit about how those are used in Hennepin, but that's unique to some of the Hennepin and Ramsey County operations. But the pure administrative law judges are not part of the judicial branch.
And on the other referees and other names, tell me, because I know you got somebody in housing court and other courts. What are we doing there? How many, and what's the difference between a referee and a different type of person?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we have about 15 full-time referees actually in our court in Hennepin County, and we utilize them in our more specialty parts of our court, and specifically in the probate mental health area, in our family court, and we have one in housing court, and we have two in juvenile court, and they, for all intents and purposes, they do judge work in those divisions, but anything they do has to be signed off on and reviewed by a judge. Essentially, we make the choice to have a referee rather than a judge, and that's a decision we've made in our court because of our size and our specialization and the fact that these referees bring many, many years of experience in certain areas of the law, like probate is a good example in mental health, and therefore have that expertise and stay in those divisions for their career.
I do a lot of work in the Hennepin County Mental Health Court, and I mean, within the probate area, they've got one judge and four referees. So, in essence, they've got five people doing the work with one judge to kind of oversee it and sign the orders. But as far as a budget, I don't know there's a lot of savings because you have to pay the referees. Each one has to have a court reporter. They don't have law clerks, and they might have somebody that might help them out. But just going to more referees doesn't always answer the question. It's an efficiency matter, but it's certainly not, in a big picture, not a budget issue.
No. Senator Betzel, that's totally correct. Our referees are primarily doing judge work, and you're absolutely correct. We pay them
90%
of what we pay a judge, and they have court reporters. Actually, we've had to give them law clerks, for example, in our family court. That's not a savings. I forgot to mention one other budget-saving thing we've done, though, you just reminded me of it. Our new judges, we've got 4 new judges started, and we're not giving them law clerks or court reporters for their beginning of their term. We're going to try and adjust their assignments so that they don't need those employees, but that's how drastic it's getting.
On that, though, you're continuing to use the reporters, because I know there's some indication that we may kind of grow out of that system or fade away or whatever you want to call it.
And this is an area. Chairman Foley, where we did, I think, make some very smart choices that saved us some money. We put in a digital recording system in our court, and we did this 2 years ago. And this digital recording system has eliminated the need for us to have any budget item for per diem reporters. And per diem reporters were very expensive, and we used to have them to cover court reporter shortages that we had. And we had court reporter shortages because there weren't enough court reporters in town actually looking for jobs for all of our judges. What we've been able to do with this court record project and the digital recording system is we put that in our arraignment courtrooms and our housing court. We've got one courtroom in juvenile court. We've put it in those places where having a live reporter is not as important. And we've saved our reporters for our pre-trials, our jury trials, our significant civil motions. And so we've managed to save some money there in terms of our per diem court reporter costs.
The recorder works independently.
Correct.
If we need a transcript, we have to pay him.
Correct.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more thing here, just for my information. Some years ago, there was satellite programs regarding interactive TV hearings. Where are we now with that statewide? And is that one way of cutting operational budgets? Is it looked at seriously, or has it not been accepted at all by the courts, or where are we at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we are exploring ITV ever more fully across the state where we feel it's appropriate and the type of hearings that it can be used. We're also exploring, and I was going to talk in a minute here, about how we could maybe use technology, telephone, and other things to help with interpreter costs and some of the ITV there. So we're definitely trying to do that where it can be done in a way that preserves the rights of the individual who's coming before the judge. So we have expanded it across the state.
Further comment? Question?
All right. Thank you very much.
At this time, I'd like to talk a little bit about our supplemental budget request. It's a yellow sheet in your packet. Last year, the judicial branch requested, based on early FY07 data, and the legislature appropriated $3.8 million for legally mandated services in the areas reflected on the screen. These are constitutionally or statutorily mandated services that the courts provide to litigants on a daily basis, and we have no choice about providing these services. Unfortunately, beginning back in fiscal year 07, the cost of many of these services have continued to rise and have surpassed even the funding that was provided by the legislature during the last session. And we have no way, as you've just heard, to try to absorb these costs in other parts of our budget, which brings us here today to talk about this supplemental request. Our supplemental request is for $1.9 million for interpreters, psychological services, and jury costs. The request outlined in this slide is different in two respects from last year's request. The first is that we believe with our current budget we can meet the cost increases that we're seeing in the guardian ad litem and the informa pauperis areas. And also significantly, last year we did not come to you with a request for jury services, but we are seeing those costs rise significantly, and so we have included jury costs in this year's request. Last fall, we began seeing the cost of these mandated services rise significantly. The Judicial Council, which is the governing body of our judicial branch, met, formed committees to begin looking at ways to become more efficient in these areas. We made a lot of policy changes and practice changes in these areas. But even with those costs still going up and moderating a little bit, they're still surpassing the budget that we currently have for mandated services. As you'll see in many of the articles that are provided in your packets, mandated services costs are one of the things that is also causing problems and issues in many of our judicial districts. The interpreter request is for $629,000. We estimated that the need, in the past, we grew at about 5% a year when we were before you before. Unfortunately, it's grown in fiscal year 07 at a rate of about 8.4%, and we are estimating that in the first half of fiscal year 08, it looks like the rate is going to be 10.2%, almost twice as high as we had estimated. And we believe that the need for this additional funding is being driven by two significant issues. One is the continued rapid increase of immigration to Minnesota. And secondly, the increased cost to provide interpreters to greater Minnesota, which increases travel costs, et cetera, related to providing those services. As you know, the Minnesota Constitution, Minnesota statutes, and the Americans with Disabilities Act provide that persons disabled in communication cannot be fully protected unless qualified interpreters are provided to assist them in legal matters. This includes deaf, hard of hearing individuals and non-English speaking persons. Fundamentally, under the Minnesota Constitution, there can be no justice without comprehension, and we must provide these interpreters in our courts. This chart is just to show you, as you can see from the graph, that immigration to Minnesota continues to climb at a steep rate. Immigration has increased in all parts of the state, not just the metro area. In fact, we are seeing many pockets in greater Minnesota growing even more rapidly than the metro area. This increase translates into increased need for interpreters. The number of people granted legal permanent residence in Minnesota, the most recent statistics we have, show that it grew from 15,456 in 2005 to 18,254 in 2006, an 18% increase in just 1 year. Similarly, when we spoke to you last year, we talked about the growth of Minnesota's non-English-speaking population from 1997 to 2005. These figures have just been recently updated by the Minnesota Department of Education and shows that from 2005 to 2006 alone, non-English-speaking students rose at a rate of 12%. These changing demographics are changing the need and the cost for the courts.
Senator Levin, thank you, Mr. Chair. On that last slide, are you aware of if that's legal immigrants or illegal?
I'm not aware if they track it as legal or illegal. I can ask just students, so I don't know that answer that question. The Education Department might know, but I'm not sure.
Well, in any event, you have to serve.
They're coming in.
Regardless of whether they're illegal or illegal.
That's correct.
Well, Mr. Chair, the question that I was trying to gain some research on is if there's a negative impact on illegal populations here, how are we prepared, and what cost is it to the taxpayer of having people that are violating federal law? That's what I want to know.
I don't have the answer.
And what can we do as a state to enforce that? Or what are we willing to do? Or the willingness is probably the greater question.
Senator Limmer, I will point out that slide number nine, the increased immigration from the demographer is, I've been told, legal immigration only. So I'm not sure about the Education Department, but that one is legal. I want to talk a little bit about our changing demographics and the changing need, just to give you a sense of the scope of the work of interpreters. Currently, we have 73 different languages on our court interpreter roster. That roster is individuals who sign up with the courts to provide services in these languages. In addition, we have languages for which we don't have rostered individuals. We may have to use telephone lines or others to provide these services. In 2007, we provided interpreters in 81 different languages in Minnesota. On average, we're using interpreters 152 times per day in the courts across the state. And this need is not limited to the metro area. Just one quick example, in Roseau, for example, we have a growing Laotian population. The nearest Laotian interpreter lives in Elk River, which is about 6 hours away from Roseau County. Last year, we needed a Laotian interpreter 12 times in Roseau County, so that individual had to drive from Elk River, and that's a significant cost, about $700 on average for a trip overnight to Roseau to provide interpreter services, so that's about $8,400 just for that one particular language in that one particular county. So we're seeing these pockets spread up across the state, and providing those services when most of our interpreters live in the metro area is a very significant travel expense for the court system. Our need and our cost is really driven by volume. The volume of interpreter events is really driving these costs, as you can see from this chart. The number of interpreter events is growing at a significant rate. In 2005, there were 31,068 events. By 2007, that had increased 21% to 37,661. In order to meet these demands, it's really a volume issue that we are facing. We're here to ask you for some sufficient funding in our supplemental request for interpreter events. I can go on and talk about the other two areas if you like, or if there are questions about interpreters.
The issue there, of course, is it's like the other items in there. Potential for a lot of things, and what I'm wondering is what's going on nationally, and do we have some examples of what other states have done in order to deal with this issue?
Mr. Chair, nationally, Minnesota in the interpreter area has been one of the leaders. We were some of the first states to form a consortium to look at interpreter issues within the courts. We were one of the first states to create a certification test for languages. We now have 8 certification tests for different languages in the courts to make sure that people are familiar with judicial language and interpreting in the court system. We've also done a lot of leadership work here in hiring staff interpreters where we can put staff interpreters so we don't have to pay for a lot of travel and contracting. As I mentioned earlier, we're also exploring, and we have in the 8th and the 7th District an individual using telephone interpreting in hearings where that's important, so he can be in one location and have telephone systems that are used in the courtrooms to provide interpreter services where he does not need to travel back and forth to those locations, so we're doing that. We're also exploring ways to work, now that we're state-funded, across district and county lines even more to provide services in a way that's the most efficient. So this problem and this issue, of course, with immigration depends on what part of the country you're in and what number of individuals are coming into the state. But what we're seeing here is these costs rise because of volume. And I think that we're doing what we can efficiency-wise, but as the numbers continue to grow, the costs just continue to grow here in Minnesota. We have about 90% of the interpreter events in the state are done through contractors, and so we have a list of contractors on the roster that we can call to come into our courthouses. Most of those are done individually. Sometimes we use agencies, and we'll call an agency, a private agency, that will have a significant number of interpreters on their own list, and they will supply those to the courts. And then, as I mentioned, we have some staff interpreters that we're using and paid as employees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me of that increase of the immigration? What are you seeing as the largest volume of your work? Is it criminal or civil of those stats?
Just a point of interest. I think we're seeing it in both areas, actually. I mean, criminal obviously is going up, and we need to be providing interpreters. But we're seeing a lot of increases in the family area, in the civil area, not just the increases that we were thinking were happening mostly in criminal. They're happening throughout the system. And some of that may be individuals who have now come into Minnesota who may be more familiar coming to the courts for domestic violence issues or family issues, not just being brought in through the criminal justice system. So it's an increase that we're seeing across the board, unfortunately. Our next request is for $758,000 in increased funding for psychological services. By statute, the courts must pay the cost for Rule 20 psychological examinations in criminal cases to determine if a person is competent to stand trial, and for court-ordered examinations to determine if a person is to be civilly committed. We use highly skilled, licensed psychologists and psychiatrists to provide these services. And as the slide indicates, almost all of these cases require two examinations. The court orders one, and under Minnesota statutes, the defendant has a right, a statutory right, to request a second examination. As you're familiar, many of these proceedings, particularly in the civil commitment area, can result in civil commitment for long periods of time. And so we have a lot of individuals who are asking for second exams, and in almost every case, a second exam is necessary to ensure that those individuals have the right to have their own examiner in these cases. So they can be very expensive. Right now, we've seen significant cost increases occurring in the psychological services area due to sexually dangerous persons, SDP, and sexual psychopathic personality, SPP, cases increasing. From 102 in fiscal year 06 to 140 in 07, which is a 37% increase. They're not only increasing, but they're also becoming more complex. The number of documents that examiners are asked to look at, the historical documents that they're asked to look at, are increasing, and that requires more time for them to look at them to provide the report following an exam. This slide shows the cost for psychological services continues to grow. From 06 to 07 alone, the cost grew at 12%, and we're estimating, as you see in the budget request, that they're going to continue to grow at about a rate of 9%, a little less, but continue to grow throughout this biennium. A lot of these costs are the result of local practices and priorities over which the court has no control. This is just an example out of Olmsted County. In all of fiscal year 07, there were 10 sexual predator commitment cases filed in Olmsted County. For the first half of fiscal year 08, there have already been 16 cases filed. Now, the average cost of cases such as this with two examiners is about $12,000. So already in fiscal year 08, we're seeing the budget for this one county alone is about $124,000 over last year. The Attorney General's Office and county prosecutors decide when to file these cases. It's based on their own priorities. As you saw in some of the articles, many of these prosecution offices have increased the number of prosecutors that they have and have placed these cases as a priority. But as these filings increase, so do the expenditures, particularly the expenditures for the court, because we have to provide these exams. And we have no choice but under statute to provide and pay for these kind of exams. So as local priorities increase and the numbers increase, so do the costs for the court system in the psychological services area.
Have we done anything in the sexual predator, those level three people, to get them out of institutions, if at all possible, or is that, to date, we still haven't gotten anybody discharged?
Mr. Chair, fortunately or unfortunately, that's not a judicial branch issue.
Mr. Chair, if the Department of Human Services gets the case.
Would be a good question. My own knowledge is there aren't very many coming out right now from those hospitals.
Mr. Chair, I guess it would appear to this that there's more going in.
There are a lot going
in. These are level threes we're talking about, are we not? Yeah, so there's more of them going in.
There's certainly more being filed, and I predict there are probably more going in also, Senator Ingerbritz.
Has that increase been due to enhanced
Chairman Foley, that increase is due to a number of different factors. Some of it is due to the fact that there seems to be a public issue with these sexual predators, and we're seeing a lot more cases filed. Some of it varies across jurisdictions. So as I mentioned in that slide with one example, prosecutors and the Attorney General's office decide when to bring these cases. We're seeing a lot more routine cases brought. So as people are getting close to coming out of prison, who have been convicted of these crimes, routinely these type of cases are brought to see if there should be civil commitment in larger numbers. So I think there are a lot of political, professional, public opinion factors that probably contribute to the number of cases that we're seeing coming into the court system for adjudication.
Mr. Chair,
A lot of it came right here in the legislature. We set forth policies to get tough on such offenders and make it, frankly, easier to commit. And another thing that happened a few years ago after the Bruce Chudin murder was that instead of having everything centrally screened at the Department of Human Services or Department of Corrections, everything was transferred out to the county attorneys. So we have 87 different counties now all looking at the cases and making independent decisions, and violence just skyrocketed because now, you know, when you have all these county attorneys doing making the decisions instead of having it all initial screening done at DOC. So I think that that's also increased the number of petitions have gotten filed that may not have gotten filed maybe in past times.
Well, I think we moved more in the area of the interfamilial problem. Results of that created.
It's a growing problem, as you said, Mr. Chair. They keep coming, in the but and once the court is done with it, actually then the process shifts for getting them out, and that's all within the Human Services budget, which, of course, you know, is a growing concern within the Human Services area because that's eating up more and more of that budget, but that's yeah. Not this budget area.
The next and last area is the jury area, and our request for jury costs is $521,000. As I mentioned earlier, last year we didn't request additional funding for this program. The number of jurors called to our courthouses had remained relatively stable between fiscal year 04 and 06. However, now we're seeing an increase in our jury costs that we can't continue to absorb internally. This slide shows that the increase in jury costs is driven primarily by the increases in felony cases, 9.6% increase, and gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor cases, 6.8% increase. After a period of relative stability in fiscal year 05 and 06, the number of trials has begun to increase dramatically, and we're expecting this to remain at this higher level throughout this biennium. This particular chart also shows that as the number of jury trials increase, it makes sense that the number of citizens who are called in for possible jury service also increases. From fiscal year 07 to fiscal year 08, this number is estimated to increase by 10%. In addition, as more people are called in, the number of individuals who actually end up serving as jurors is going up. The number of individuals sworn in as jurors has also increased. We saw it go up 6.4% in fiscal year 07 and is expected to grow an additional 4% in fiscal year 08. So as Judge Whelan mentioned, as she's seeing in Hennepin County, we're seeing across the state with greater felony trials and gross misdemeanor, misdemeanor trials, our jury costs increase, which is why we've included this as part of our request. In summation, our request for this $1.9 million for these mandated services is for costs that we cannot contain and certainly cannot control. They come to the court system. We're mandated to pay them. Unfortunately, given the rest of our budget, we're not able to absorb them, which is why we're here in these times, unfortunately, asking for your assistance to help with these $1.9 million in additional mandated services costs that we'll be experiencing throughout this biennium. Thank you.
Members have a question.
Mr. Chair, if these are mandated mandated services, why wasn't this put in as a deficiency bill as opposed to just a supplemental budget request? And maybe Ms. Dosal is the right person.
I don't know the answer to that, Senator Higgins.
Because we have, in Finance Committee yesterday, we had a list of various things that we were supposed to pay for that were deficiencies in, like, state budgets and things like that. And and if these are mandated services, they should have been right in there with that, I think. But then I don't know how one actually decides what qualifies for a deficiency and what's just a supplemental.
Senator Higgins, I mean, the deficiency bill dealt with issues like, you know, we had three agencies that we've appropriated money for them, but they had things coming up where investigations and so forth because of unique situations where they absolutely had no funds to proceed. Mm-hmm. And the Sesquicentennial Commission was another one. If we didn't deal with it right now, they were going to have to shut down. I think the courts and some of the other agencies, you know, they may be struggling, have to do things internally, and
even the courts, I mean, they have problems here that they're bringing to our attention. But, you know, they've done some things along the way to try to deal with that. Mr. Chair, if I can just share, I talked with our former colleague, Judge Neville, a few weeks ago. And, you know, I asked him how it was being on the bench, and he said, you know, all the stuff that they told us about the judges and the resources, he said, it's all true. And he said, now, you know how meticulous he was about, you know, wanting to read everything. In a three-day period, he had like 80 cases, you know, that he had to process. And, of course, since he's the new judge, they gave him the easier 80 cases, but still it was 80 cases. And one case he had a thick file handed to him and said, "This, you're going to go on the bench in 5 minutes and you're going to have to hear this case." And he had to call the attorneys up and said, "I don't know what's in here. You guys are going to have to tell me this." But he told me he went to his first judge's meeting and, you know, thinking, wow, here I'm a district court judge going to my... And the first thing they said was, we got a million-dollar problem. And we're going to... And it's because of interpreters and psychologists. We have to pay an interpreter for 4 hours even if they come down for 10 minutes to Northfield. So, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, we're going to be hearing more and more about some of these things, and that's just, as I said, what Judge Neville passed on to me and asked me to share with you. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Further questions or comments? And your presentation is concluded.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Why do we always have that same presentation every one of us?
Jeez, you got an awful big rating there. You got all that.
Hey, we have bad eyes in the system.
All in favor. Next, we have Kevin Kyer.
Throwing balls?
Kevin.
Can't afford that. We had to cut that out of our budget. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. For the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Thank you for allowing me to come before you and follow the court, because I don't have to repeat all of the things that our friends from the court mentioned in terms of the current budget situation. Let me preface my remarks by first of all saying we understand the financial situation you all are facing or will be facing as of Thursday. And we are also facing the same kinds of issues relative to personnel in the court. I'm not going to go through all of those. I think Mr. Shorba and those folks did a fine job of outlining those issues. Suffice it to say, we're facing those same issues. We started out this year after the salary settlements with about a $3 million problem. We instituted a hiring freeze in December. We've whittled that down to about a $1.8 million deficit for this year. That's the good news, and it looks like it's coming down. The bad news is, again, as even the court indicated, we have about 5 or 6% of our attorney staff that's now vacant just because we don't have the money to fill those spots. So we are working on that. We are not here to ask for additional funding for this year. We're going to try to take care of that problem through the hiring freeze, through a freeze on contracting, through some other things that we're doing in order to save some money. A couple of things that I do wish to mention, though. We're all for efficiency in the court. You know, I don't think anybody would be here to argue against that. But just a couple of notes. When I hear things about e-charging, when I hear things about ITV, I get a little nervous because those end up being cost shifts to the Board of Public Defense and our defenders. And what may be good for the prosecutors, Mr. Chairman, sure. For example, the e-charging. It's a wonderful opportunity. But if we don't have the resources in our IT area to be able to accept those e-charges and those documents, that's going to be a significant cost factor to us. For example, one of the things that a lot of the county prosecutors want to do now is go to electronic discovery. Okay. Well, about half of our staff is part-time, as you all know, and especially in the rural areas. They don't have the capability to handle those kind of big files that may be coming across their desk with their little office computer. Some of them have limited access or at least limited high-speed internet access, too. So those are all things you have to take into account. Again, we're not against it. I think it's just that this body and I think the court have to recognize some of those issues are not necessarily cost savings to the entire system. As far as ITV is concerned, if the rules apply and we have to have a lawyer on each end of ITV, just from a cost savings, again, not talking about the philosophical arguments, all of a sudden now we have to have lawyers in two different spots, one in the courtroom, one in the jail. So the cost savings to maybe the court, to the sheriff's departments, which I fully understand, they don't want to be transporting folks back and forth. It's a big cost to them. All of a sudden, they now may be one that's shifted onto our office. So those are the things.
Mr. Chair, just tie into that, too. It goes in other areas, too. As I indicated, I do a lot of civil commitment defense work in Hennepin County, and they've talked about the idea of interactive television for cases where patients down at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter, rather than transporting them up, which gets very expensive to the sheriff, just have the TV interacted down there. But then the defense lawyer has to say, well, should I be down there in St. Peter with my client, or should I be in the courtroom? Because I can't be in both places. Or do we have to hire two attorneys, one to be in St. Peter, one to be in the courtroom? So there really aren't any savings for ITV in many of these cases.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman and members, the last piece was just of the end of sexual psychopaths, sexual dangerous personalities. We do the end of confinement review hearings on those, and we've seen the same kind of increase in terms of folks wanting to challenge their designation, the appeal process, and that's been a major resource drain for our appellate office. So having said that, Mr. Chairman, having prefaced my remarks, we still have an operation to run. We still have issues that we have to deal with. And we understand there's a financial problem. But on the other hand, we do have some issues in terms of recruiting and retaining public defenders. And I think it would be short-sighted of us to say, well, there's a budget crisis, there's a budget problem, so we're not going to address some of these issues or at least raise these issues and bring them forward, which is why you have the Loan Repayment Assistance Program in front of you. We are asking for two things. One is the permission to put together a loan replacement or repayment program and also the funding for that. And it basically comes down to a couple of issues. One is recruitment and one is retention. Enhancing recruitment in greater Minnesota. As I mentioned, about half of our staff is part-time. When you get outside the metro area, it's about 60%. Recently, the feds passed a college cost reduction program. And how it works, or one of the pieces that works, is after 10 years of public service, if you have a federally insured loan or a direct federal loan, you can have that loan forgiven after 10 years of service. That option is not available to part-time defenders. In addition, a number of our folks, most of our full-time folks, in fact, either have private loans from law school or they have loans that have been consolidated already, which means that it's not in their economic interest, or if they're private loans, they don't qualify for that federal loan assistance program. That's why we're here today. We're here to talk about putting together a program that would allow the folks that are already with us, both full and part-time, to have some kind of benefit that's roughly equal to what that federal loan forgiveness program would provide.
I had a question, yes. The federal program, you said that does not include public defenders. Who does it include?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lindbergh, it doesn't include part-time public defenders. Right.
are there programs for public prosecutors?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, not that I'm aware of. The one local program that is a loan repayment assistance program is run through the Bar Association. It's called LRAP, the legal, I forgot what the acronym is, but it's assistance program. It's a very small program run by the Bar Association. I think the income limit the last time we checked was about $37,000 a year, something like that. And I believe that might have been household income. They are the folks we have been talking with about running this program for us, if, in fact, we were able to find the funding to do it.
Chair, the question I have is maybe just a fear that if we had this in place, could that possibly sprout a number of different public attorney jobs all seeking the same thing, claiming they'd like to stay in public service, and man, would they ever like to have their loan for their law school paid off. And so I'm a little concerned about how far this may really go if this went in.
The difference, though, Senator Limmer, is the fact that a job as a prosecutor is generally there's not a money factor in there. It's a different kind of a job than being a public defender, at least a full-time public defender. So if you're sitting there with $100,000 in loans, you want to figure out some way to get that out of there.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to understand that. A person that's a new or a younger prosecutor, public prosecutor, working in a public prosecutor's office, do they get paid the same as a public defender? Help me understand that. Why would they have a different approach toward this repayment of their loan on a law school loan than a public defender? Help me understand the difference.
My thought on that, Senator Limmer, is that the individuals get paid less as a public defender.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, I think the prosecutors are facing some of the similar same issues that we are. We have not had any formal discussion with the prosecutors about this particular proposal, but I've talked to Mr. Kingery on a number of occasions. And they're facing some of these same issues in terms of recruiting part-time prosecutors out in the rural areas, because a number of those folks are part-time, although they're getting more and more full-time folks, and also some retention issues as well.
Is the pay scale similar?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, it's all over the map, obviously. They have 87 different governing bodies, which is probably why they're not here talking to you about loan assistance, because they're not a state agency and they're not state employees. We have one pay scale, you know, statewide. I will tell you, ours is significantly lower than a number of counties, and in the counties where most of our cases occur, our salaries are lower than the prosecutors. In some of the outstate or the greater Minnesota area, it is a little better. So it is all over the map. Mr. Chairman and members, really what we're looking at is a baby boom workforce. And if you turn to page 4 and 5 of the handout, about 40% of our part-time defenders are age 50-plus. About 30% of all public defenders are over age 50. And if you look at those on page 5, about 74% of the defenders who are over age 55 are part-time. These are the folks that have been with us an awfully long time. They're the ones with established practices. I'm sure Senator Ingebrigtsen knows some of those in his district, particularly in some of those, more rural areas. And we just don't have the folks that are willing to come out, hang out a shingle, and then accept a part-time public defender position to do the work. I think the doctors have gone through this. Yeah, I think you've seen that. The nurses have gone through this, trying to attract doctors and nurses to different parts of the state of Minnesota. If you look at page 6, the difficulty we've had in recruitment, the last two part-time applications that we put out in northeastern and northwestern Minnesota, the 9th and 6th judicial districts, one, we had 3 applicants. The other one, we didn't have any. And that's what we're starting to face now as we move forward. We just don't have those folks who are willing to do this kind of work out there. As we move to the metro area, we have a different issue. As I mentioned, our salaries are considerably lower than the prosecutors in those areas, and our attrition rates have increased dramatically. In 2006, we had about a 10% attrition rate among lawyers in our organization. It's inefficient. I mean, it's inefficient for the court because obviously we either don't have people or we got to bring people in. We got to train them. What we're finding is we bring them in, we train them, and then after about 4 or 5 years, 6 years, then they move on and they're doing something else. What we have found is if we can keep them past that year, about year six, we pretty much have them. By that time, they've started a family. They have, you know, they've moved on to, you know, they've bought their house. They're moving into a more settled age, and we can keep them, which is why this is so important to a number of our defenders. If you look on page eight and nine, in terms of the recruitment and retention, what we've seen is nationwide, there was a survey done in nationwide employers of lawyers. 88% of them identified law school debt as a barrier to recruiting lawyers. About 82% identified as a major barrier to retaining lawyers. Law school tuition, which I don't think we have to tell any of you, is increased 267% since 1990. And in addition, 66% of the graduates that come out of law school, this was a Bar Association study, said that debt prevented them pursuing some kind of public service, not necessarily just public defense, but public service in general. About 90%, if you turn to the next page, about 90% of our attorneys have reported that they had law school debt at some point. Right now, about 65% of them have current debt from law school. The average debt is about $74,000. The average monthly payment is about $586. 54% of them are respondents of 6 or less years of experience, and that's the part that really concerns us. We did a survey of our folks to get that information. I saw law school debt as high as $180,000 in those responses to surveys. Obviously, some folks don't have any. But if you can imagine 100 or 180,000, it's just an incredible amount of money. So, it could, but they'd have to go inform a papyrus to do it, Mr. Chairman. So what we're looking at, Mr. Chairman and members, is, again, as we indicated, a law school loan repayment assistance program. And here's how we are proposing that it would work. The value of that federal law school forgiveness program is based on the numbers that we showed you, the $74,000, is about roughly $40,000 to $45,000. So what we are asking for, what we're proposing, is a 10-year program, just like on the federal level, where each year we would pay up to $4,500 a year towards someone's law school loan debt. You work for a year. We pay you the $4,500. You work for another year, you get another $4,500 up to that 10 years. Again, roughly equivalent to what the new hires who would be eligible for federal loan forgiveness would also be getting. As I mentioned, we had been talking with the folks at LRAP to run this program and for a couple of reasons. One is obviously they have the infrastructure in place already and the administrative setup to do it. The second one is the way their program works or historically has worked is they take the loan that you have, they forgive, let me back up, they make you a loan to cover your law school debt or some portion thereof, and then they forgive that loan. So far, that's been a tax-exempt transaction, and they have not been challenged on that, which obviously would be the other benefit or a huge benefit to our folks to have it tax-exempt rather than us doing it, which would be a taxable event for those individuals. Mr. Chairman, that's the Loan Repayment Assistance Program. Again, we understand the money situation you folks are facing. But I think we would be remiss in not trying to address some of those issues that we have, namely the recruitment and retention of folks, particularly in the rural areas, but also here in the metro area.
My classmates had a lot of difficulty raising the money, but I unfortunately that money of my own. It's all right, but the amount was higher. $90,000 was mostly what people in Billy Mitchell. And the other part of it is that the number of those folks have got an undergraduate program that they haven't paid off yet. So it's a tough deal. And you know, in some other fields, you can get out of them by graduation and find an opportunity to get a job there, but in the law business, it's not very highly paid.
Mr. Chairman, we do have one other budget request in front of you. As some of you may recall, last session there was a study that you all mandated regarding public defender costs in Hennepin County and what the state paid versus what the county paid. And, Mr. Chairman, I think we sent you a copy of that report, and I think, Senator Higgins, you have a copy of that somewhere, I'm sure.
Somewhere.
As an outgrowth of that, and you know, we put together that report with the Hennepin County folks, and we thought it was at least incumbent upon us to come forward with some kind of recommendation to you on that issue. Right now, as best we can determine in working with the folks at Hennepin County, they are paying about $3.9 million a year for services that we would otherwise provide the cost of in other judicial districts, other counties. They are the only county that provides that kind of funding, and there's a long history of that or historical reasons, and I see the time is starting to run short. I don't know if you want to go through that or not. I think most of you who have been around the table have been down that path before, and I know Mr. Turner certainly has, so I'm sure he could probably enlighten you on that. But we did feel it was, you know, an obligation for us to bring that forward, to identify those. We were certainly happy to provide the copy of that report to any of you that would like to see it. The other piece that's in there is a one-time appropriation to move that office. The current building that those folks are in has some asbestos problems, has some lead paint problems. Those folks have moved out, but it's now the issue of not only the moving costs, but where they're going to go on a permanent basis. The $3.9 million is almost exclusively personnel-related cost. And again, we can go into more detail on that, Mr. Chairman, but I know that you and I have had that discussion, and I know most of the folks around the table have heard that as well. So I'm happy to stand for any questions on that. I will mention there were two other options, or at least one other option in that report, and that was to work somewhere through the tax committee as well. There have been exceptions in the local aid formulas for costs that counties have incurred either through these takeovers or some other issues where there's exceptions made in that local aid formula. Now, this would be a very big one. But that was another option identified in the report. But we did feel we should come forward with it and at least raise the issue with you folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. Earlier in your presentation, you said there was places in Minnesota that don't have access to high-speed Internet. Where would that be?
Mr. Chairman, what we have found is, at least in the rural and part-time areas, I should say greater Minnesota, up in the 9th Judicial District, a lot of it is high speed, but it's over, and again, I have to get my IT people here, about over copper wiring. And so it's not is high speed, but the transaction itself is having trouble. And again, it's an issue of a number of our folks who are part-time don't have that investment in the equipment and everything else. So. Chairman, I will mention the bill for law school loan repayment assistance has been introduced. I guess it was got introduced yesterday, but Senator Latz graciously agreed to do that. I believe it actually got referred to the Higher Ed Committee.